Ellen Tebbets was in a hurry. As she ran down Tillamook Street with her ballet slippers tucked under her arm, she did not even stop to scuff through the autumn leaves on the sidewalk. The reason Ellen was in a hurry was a secret she would never, never tell.
That was the opening paragraph of Ellen Tebbets by Beverly Cleary. You are listening to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And I'm John McCoy.
And we're discussing Ellen Tebbets, Beverly Cleary's second novel for children.
Right. And as we were discussing before we started talking here, it opens in a very similar manner to Henry Huggins. It opens with the character's name. It opens with the character's immediate situation. I think that it says a lot about the way Beverly Cleary likes to situate her readers, in that she just tosses them down and we catch up with them.
Yeah, yeah. She doesn't mess around with a whole lot of set dressing. She knows what kids... As a child, especially at the age where she was aiming for, when I remember picking up novels and being daunted if there was a little too much waffling at the beginning. I really just sort of wanted to jump right into the story. So I think she knew that. I mean, having worked with enough children as a librarian, she was probably well aware that kids need a little more of an immediate introduction than they don't need a whole lot of backstory right off the bat.
Right. But it also opens with a hook. We have the hook of Ellen Tebbets having a secret. And I think that it's telling that this is the way this story begins, because if Henry Huggins was a book for... I mean, let's be honest, these are very gendered books in a way. Henry Huggins was a book written for boys, and this is sort of a book written, I think, more for girls. It already, from the beginning, we have... an emphasis on Ellen's interior life, which, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Boys are less interested in interior lives than little girls are. What do you think? Am I digging my grave here?
I don't know if it's so much digging your grave as I was thinking about that, too. So much. I don't know if it's so much that she's now writing for a girl. I also think she's becoming a better writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was part of, like, what we talked about with Henry Huggins, because with Henry Huggins, there wasn't so much of a through line for the novel itself as far as the plot went. I think as a writer, what she's starting to play with is the idea that these novels, if they don't have a very strong plot, they can at least have a strong emotional arc for the characters. And so that at the end of the book, they've changed as a person, even if their situation is roughly the same. I'm not saying this book doesn't have a better plot than... I think this book has a far better plot than Henry Huggins, more of a plot than Henry Huggins. But I think she's also becoming more comfortable focusing on the inner life of kids. Now, I guess... I mean, we haven't touched on them yet, but the later Henry Huggins books do stay a little more on the surface than this one.
Well, I think you're right that this... The arc of this story focuses much more on Ellen's internal movement and her struggle towards, you know, it's a story about becoming friends with someone, and it's a story about the anxiety that especially children have about whether or not their friends actually accept them, whether or not they are accepted by their teachers. Ellen is much more than Henry ever was, very concerned about her place in the world and very concerned about finding affection. She's an only child. Henry was an only child too, but Ellen has all these kinds of tentative movements. I mean, towards the friendship that she develops and certainly towards her teacher. So I think that those things are both, you know, where Henry Huggins was made up of a bunch of sort of wacky vignettes that were kind of much more like sitcom-y, here's something funny that happens to a boy and his dog. In some ways, the individual chapters of Ellen Tebbets don't have as much physical action as Henry Huggins, but they have a lot more emotional interior action than Henry Huggins.
Right. And the chapters themselves aren't necessarily individual stories. Like, this is the first time we see plot, like the plot, the setup carry over into the next chapter. Two of the stories get interrupted by chapter breaks. The Beat story gets interrupted by a chapter break, as well as the whole saga at the end with the slap and the rat and the resolution of that. Like, that covers three chapters, if I remember correctly. So I think what she's done is she's not only built a stronger inner life for the main character, she's also put together a stronger cohesive story than Henry Huggins had. It's not a series of wacky adventures. Henry Huggins, someone mentioned online, I can't remember in what capacity, but someone mentioned the novel Homer Price.
Right.
As sort of an example of what Henry Huggins, the genre Henry Huggins was a part of. And I'll say that Henry Huggins is more to that genre of, it's a little wackier and sitcomier and a little more unrealistic. Because it relies on coincidence and situations. It doesn't have like a wacky donut machine, but it certainly isn't as naturalistic as Beverly Cleary's writing ends up becoming, which I'd say that Ellen Tebbutt's relies far less on hijinks than Henry Huggins did. All it has, it's, you know, it has it with the maypole and the rat mask and everything. It has its share of hijinks, but it's not as at the forefront. It's not driving the story as much.
I'll agree, but I will also say that when I reread this book, I realized how little of the actual plot points I remembered. I remembered very much the segment with the Beat, which I think is the one chapter of any Beverly Cleary book that stuck with me through the years in a very strange way. I also remember the scene of her clapping erasers, because that seemed like a very idyllic picture to me. And I was very happy to come across that again when I read this book. But other than that, I don't remember the individual chapters. I'll agree with you that this book has a much better through line and I think represents a strong step forward for Beverly Cleary. It was only written a year after Henry Huggins, so she's moving along a pace.
It's an interesting book. I've read it twice. I read it twice now in the last couple of weeks, and I'd read it just recently, not terribly long before then, before we even came up with the idea of this show, just because I've been reading the Beverly Cleary books to my younger child. And the one thing that struck me about Ellen Tebbutt's, and I had read it when I was younger. I hadn't realized I'd read it when I was younger, but then on reread, I was like, oh, I know this story. I remember these beats. I remember this stuff happening. The beats and the beat. But the thing that struck me on rereading it is that, and I don't know if this is a positive or a negative. Once when I read it, it was a negative. The next time I read it, it was a positive. Ellen Tebbutt's is an extremely flawed character. Main character. Austine Allen is her best friend and is far more grounded, far quicker. She seems far more aware of what's going on. She's almost the perfect friend. Ellen at times, several times throughout the book, does very questionable things as a friend. And Austine is, if not quick to forgive, she does forgive. She seems a little wise beyond her years. And I don't know if that's because she's from California, but it's because it really struck me that in another world, this would be Austine's story. This would be the story of a girl who'd moved and was trying to come to terms with the fact that she had moved to a new state, had no friends, and had met this kind of troubling, clueless young girl named Ellen Tebbutt's who was kind of awful in her own way, but was at heart a good person. But instead, we're seeing it from Ellen's perspective. So we get a bit of, I mean, even though the narrator is, you know, it's sort of the omniscient narrator, it's all from Ellen's perspective. So we get this weird, we get this unreliability on her part when she treats Austine terribly. she never seems to realize that she's at fault. And the narration doesn't betray that. The narration tries to keep you on Ellen's side throughout the entire end of the book, where Ellen does something horrible to Austin and sits around expecting an apology from Austin. And at one point when I read it, it made me dislike Ellen a lot because I was just like, but then the next time I read it, I understood more what Beverly Cleary was saying. I mean, she was telling the story from a child's perspective, and children aren't that aware. And it made more sense. It seemed very genuine to me.
Well, the other thing that I think you touch on right there is the way that the narrative voice inhabits Ellen's head. This is what people like to talk about in Jane Austen as the free indirect style, when the narrative voice takes on a personality and takes on a point of view that's close to the main character. And because so much of this deals with Ellen's anxieties in this opening segment where Ellen has the secret is that she's wearing long underwear and she doesn't want anyone to find out because she's going to her ballet class and she can't think of anything less dignified or less graceful or appropriate to being a ballet dancer than wearing long underwear. And whether or not as a child you have any affinity for that. I mean, obviously as a boy, I did not take ballet classes. I did not have the anxiety of having long underwear under my, tutu. But I could feel very strongly the anxiety in Ellen's head. And I think that's one of the great things that Clary does is she takes that very seriously, whether or not you know, it could be a joke. And in a way there is a kind of a diffusion of the tension at the end of this chapter, but it is treated with all seriousness that this is a very big problem for Ellen.
Oh, indeed. And that actually brings up a point that I was making to you online a little while ago, and you were like, save it for the podcast, which is in this first chapter, the basic idea of which is that Ellen has to wear long underwear to ballet. She doesn't want to be seen changing out of it, so she throws her leotard on over it and then has to struggle through ballet class wearing long underwear that's constantly bunching up without anyone finding out about it. In addition to that, there's a new girl in her class, Austin Allen, who just moved up from California and won't stop talking about California, who annoys Ellen. There's also the intrusion on their ballet class of a young man named Otis Spofford, who is the son of the ballet teacher, who disrupts the class by participating in it in full cowboy gear. There's also Ellen trying to be a good ballet dancer and sort of pursue this interest that she has by paying attention in class. There's a gaggle of girls who are at times just being young girls. They're also at times being somewhat mean-spirited. It's kind of hard to get a read on exactly what their attitude toward the whole situation is. Otis is wearing spurs. He's popping bubble gum. I brought this up a while back because I feel like the first chapter of this book, it's a long chapter, is a little overstuffed. At the end of it all, I feel it does a good job of playing up just the extreme stress of the situation. But I also feel like there could be elements of the story that could have been introduced a little later. I felt like Beverly Cleary was kind of hedging her bets and trying to get everything out in the open. And it doesn't sit quite right with me because I feel like Otis's mother, as the ballet teacher, doesn't seem to notice that Otis is actually in the classroom half the time. If she was supposed to be like an overly permissive mother, I don't think that sold very well. I don't know. The whole opening, it's a neat story, but I didn't feel like it had to have been as stuffed as it was, because I feel like it goes on just a little bit long and tries to do a few too many things. And then the whole thing with someone wearing uncomfortable clothing underneath their clothing actually gets pulled off to a much better degree several books later in the Ramona series. when she wears her pajamas underneath her clothes. I feel like that's a refinement of this introduction to a character done a lot better.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder if this has something to do with Cleary's writing process, because when I was reading her autobiographical books, you keep coming across these instances from childhood that you realize she took and cannibalized for her story. She took little incidences. Later in this book, there's a sequence where Ellen Tebbets is biked in a bicycle basket by an older boy, and how grateful she is to this older boy for doing that. And it turns out that when Beverly Cleary herself was young, she had this experience with a much older boy who would bike her around in her basket, and she felt very special having done that. And I think that there are lots of these little sequences, like in Henry Huggins, where Henry is carrying Ribsy in the box, which came from a story that Beverly Cleary had heard, where she just has sort of that situation in mind, and she builds out the story from the situation, which is a kind of an opposite direction from the way that I think you're taught to write in fiction class, where you're taught to create strong characters and just sort of follow them along and see where they go. Now, I don't think any way is either better or worse, but I think that both of those techniques have different side effects. And in this case, I think the side effect is, as you say, it kind of moves out and spreads in kind of awkward directions. There's kind of a whole coda at the end of this first chapter where Ellen and Austin start talking about themselves that doesn't really kind of fit with the action of the rest of the chapter. But I don't know. It just seems sort of like she didn't quite know where she wanted to get that information in, so she just kind of stuck it there.
Right. I feel like the end of chapter one might have been added because it sort of has a parallel in the last chapter, the way Austin and Ellen are talking in the last chapter about cooking and brownies again. I'm wondering if that came later, like was tacked on so she could sort of have this, like, the first time they become friends, and then when they become friends again, they bond over this, like, sort of trivial thing about their lives, which is that Ellen is very awkward in the kitchen and Austin is very confident in the kitchen. Because at the end of this chapter, they do end up becoming friends, even though Ellen was awful to Austin right off the bat in this book. She's nervous and she gripes at Austin about just going on and on about California, even though Austin is obviously very homesick. I want to talk just a little bit about Austin as a character. She is an outsider. She comes from a family of they seem they're more more outgoing, more freewheeling family than Ellen's. The next chapter begins with a description of their home lives. Her mother is very very clean. She cares about her house a lot. It seems like Ellen lives in a much more strict household. She likes going to Austin's because everything's a little messier. The mom doesn't mind when they spill stuff on the floor. And Austin likes going to Ellen's. I don't remember why Austin likes going to Ellen's. Because the house is full of interesting things. We get this nice introduction of Austin as a competent person, a confident person, a young girl who is, she's very independent because she's very, I mean, she's alone. And she puts up with a lot of stuff. Ellen berates her when they first meet. But then in the next chapter, Ellen goes and finds a beat, and Austin not only sticks up for her in class, ends up engineering the situation so that Ellen is not disappointed. Sort of takes Ellen on as a project, like Ellen's desires become Austin's. Like Austin manipulates the classroom so that Ellen's beat is not forgotten about. It's a completely selfless act. Like Austin gets nothing out of it. She gets no recognition for it. She's presented as a truly kind person who puts up with Ellen's neuroses and just her misconceptions up until the moment where Ellen actually physically assaults her.
Right.
To put it in not very sweet terms, she hits Austin in the face because of a misunderstanding.
Right. I like what you mentioned, the difference between the two houses, because this was actually something that resonated with me as I was reading it. This time I was thinking back to being about this age, and at about this age was the time as a child when you got to go over to other people's houses on your own, rather than in the context of a birthday party or a play date with the parents around you. And you got to kind of try on a larger world. And I remember having a very close friend who lived in an incredibly messy house, just filled with all kinds of crazy things. The mother collected little glass figurines, sort of like Tennessee Williams, the glass menagerie. The father collected chess sets, and the whole family had about 3 dozen board games, but they took all the board game pieces and threw them together into a garbage bag. And whenever anyone wanted to play Monopoly, they would have to go rooting around this garbage bag and pull out the right board. And then they'd pull out some random assortment of pieces. And quite often the games became sort of hybrid games because all the pieces got mixed together. And as a kid, I just had no idea people could live this way. And it fascinated me so much. And so reading this made me think about that. I was kind of, you know, because I'm old and cynical, I was trying to get a kind of a read on whether there was something about class going on in this discussion. Because later in the book, a very important plot point turns on the fact that Ellen's mother makes her clothes, whereas Austin's mother buys her clothes. And I don't know that it was class so much as perhaps a clash of sort of the pre-war do-it-yourself household versus the post-war buy everything at a store household. I don't know. Did you get any feeling about that?
I got a definite. I'm not sure what Beverly Cleary was going for, but there's three mothers introduced in this book, Ellen's, Austin's, and Otis's. And the first thing you learn about Otis's mother, she's the first mother you encounter because she's the ballet teacher, is that she's unusual because she does not go by her proper name of Mrs. John Spofford. She goes by her own first name, which is weird in the town. And that part always like strikes me as very like there's an expectation of what a wife and a mother is supposed to be. And I felt that it was Austin's mother buys her clothes, not because they're well off, but because Austin's mother doesn't sew, which is weird and unusual and something that an artist or someone from California would do. Like, I would say that instead of it being Ellen's mother can't afford to buy the clothes, I think that Ellen's mother is doing what's expected, which is make your kids dresses, because that is what it seems that a woman is supposed to be in this neighborhood. And that to me, it sort of set Austin's family apart as kind of being the outsiders. Like, what are you doing buying all your kids' clothes? You should be building them. And that's what I got, at least.
Right. But again, it's because the narrative voice takes Ellen's side. We see anything that strays from Ellen's expectations of what a mother is, what a woman should do for their family, as being strange and new. And that's very true, I think, to, again, this time in childhood, when you go out and you, for the first time, encounter someone who does something completely unexpected, your first impulse, I think, as a child is to be scandalized in a way.
I mean, you bring it up now, and it's easy to forget that this story is very biased towards Ellen's perception. Later on, when they do the horseback riding, Austin asks her father if they can do it, and he, without hesitation, well, there's a little hesitation, mostly just for their safety, but he spends money on his daughter and on her friend without it being a big deal. There's no talk about, like, you know, money is tight. There's nothing that you see later on in the Ramona world, where the expense of a horseback ride would definitely be a topic of discussion. Maybe that is what she was going for. Maybe we are subtly supposed to get that Austin's family has a little more money than most of the kids in the neighborhood, that they are, without realizing it, from different socioeconomic backgrounds, because they're kids, so they only deal with each other on a personal level and not on that sort of social level.
Let's talk about the Beat story, which we've brought up now a bit. The context of the story is that Ellen has a teacher, Miss Joyce, whom she desperately wants to feel accepted by and loved by.
The first in a long line of Beverly Cleary idealized young teachers.
It's interesting because, again, if you go back and you read Cleary's own autobiography, she had a very complex relationship with school. She had a bad experience with a teacher that kind of turned her off of reading for a long time. It's hard to believe that Beverly Cleary spent several years of her childhood not resisting reading, and then something changed. I think she had a good teacher who brought about that change in her. And I think that Cleary is quite sensitive to the ways in which the grown-ups around a child, and particularly teachers around a child, can have enormous effects on that child's personality. And Ellen's interior life is that she worries that her teacher doesn't like her because she never picks her to clap erasers. And again, whether or not you grew up with a schoolroom where there were blackboards or not, I don't know to what extent blackboards are around these days anymore.
They aren't around at all.
but I think everyone can kind of imagine the satisfying feeling of clapping those erasers together. But also that totemic way that Ellen holds this up as the sign of her teacher's affection is quite remarkable, because I think even as a child, I got both that this was deadly serious to Ellen, and yet nobody else around Ellen probably treated it the same way. It was a kind of a very personal symbolism that Ellen gave to these erasers.
Well, and the teacher herself later on, like, regards it as menial, like dirty work. That you find out she never asks Ellen to clap erasers because Ellen always comes to school dressed so nicely, and she figured Ellen wouldn't want to get her clothes dirty. I think it's one of those plot points that rests entirely on a kid acting like a kid, which is not actually just going ahead and asking the teacher. Like, if Ellen would just raise her hand or go up to the teacher's desk and say, "Can I clap erasers one day?" the teacher would have said yes, and that would have been the end of it. But Ellen's neuroses, like that what you were talking about, that, like, just that deep-seated desire, like, her inner life is so strong and overrides a lot of, like, what's logically occurring on the outside, that that it never occurs to her to simply ask this lovely young teacher why she hasn't been selected to go clap erasers. And so she concocts an elaborate scheme, not even a scheme, like, just it's this incredibly elaborate way of earning someone's affection in the most just roundabout way possible that only would make sense to a child this age.
Because the teacher has a class discussion about perennial plants and then talks about biennial plants, plants that only produce flowers every 2 years, and how rare they are, and points out the fact that beets are in fact biennial, that nobody ever sees beet flowers because people eat the beets within the year. And Ellen recalls that she has seen a beet growing in a lot, and she offers to bring this beet to class, and she thinks this will be surely the thing that will get her teacher's notice. As you say, a very peculiar plan, but
she thinks that this is something that's so special and rare, and it is a beet growing in the alley that's so old that it has an enormous flower on it. But it's she has to wake up really early the next morning because she has to dig it up before school.
Right.
And Austin proves herself to be untrustworthy as far as like getting out of the house on time, because she has to do it by herself since Austin's not ready to go.
I feel that that was Clary wanting to shoo away all the peripheral characters, because what happens next is, as a child reading this, I recall this passage going on much longer than it actually does in the book, because I had never read anything quite like this before, which was a description of Ellen in the rain attempting to dig up this beet. And it's this epic struggle in a way of sort of a child against nature. And I had never read any kind of lengthy description of someone doing something laborious like this before. And I was genuinely concerned for her well-being as a child. I didn't know quite where this was going.
Oh, and then she, I mean, it's a physically grueling act. It's in, like you said, it's in the rain, it's in the mud. She's wearing nice clothes because she always dresses nicely. And then she is interrupted by the neighbor, who you discover it's actually the neighbor's beat. So more or less, like, the neighbor doesn't seem too concerned about it. She's more concerned there's a kid in the lot by the house digging up this beat. But she lets Ellen keep the beet. Ellen then has to haul it to school. It's, of course, filthy and bleeding beet juice. she gets a lift to school in the basket of an older boy's bike, who's a Boy Scout, so he's doing his good deed. By the time Ellen gets to school, she's covered in mud. She's ripped her dress. She thinks she runs into Otis, who says, "You're going to get sent home because you're wearing filthy clothes." And it's the intervention of Austin, level-headed Austin, who's like, "Don't worry, I went ahead of you. I told the teacher you might be late because you're getting the beat. Come with me to the bathroom. We'll clean you up. I'll mend your dress with tape. No one will even notice you're dirty." Austin comes in and saves the day. And then Otis has brought...
Well, there's a chapter break here. And this is one of those things that, in a way, it's funny to even mention, because if you read most books, you think nothing of these chapter breaks, but this is so kind of odd and shocking in a way, when you're so used to Cleary having these kind of little set piece chapters, like everything goes along in Henry Huggins, gets neatly wrapped up, and now it's sort of next week's episode with the next chapter.
But it ends on Austin's declaration that Ellen is her best friend,
right?
Which is something that Ellen's been worried about. She doesn't know if they're actually best friends, even though they are quite clearly best friends at this point, because Austin's never said it. And Otis is making fun of Ellen, and Austin rushes to her defense and says, "Ellen is my best friend, and I won't have you picking on her." Chapter break.
Right.
Giving it the import that Beverly Cleary obviously felt it deserved.
Right. And I think it shows, again, her command as an author. Is she's starting to grow into that. You know, she is, I think, owning more these emotional moments and letting them breathe correctly.
And it also jumps ahead a few minutes to Ellen being mostly cleaned off. It almost feels like a commercial break.
Right.
Because you cut back to the story, and then Ellen, they're finishing up cleaning up Ellen in the bathroom, and we're on to the second half of the tale. Which is their involvement, the schoolroom politics of Science Day, however that works. Because Otis has brought a pocket full of Mexican jumping beans, and all of a sudden the students are more interested in those than they are in some dirty old beet.
Do they still sell Mexican jumping beans?
No, they're given a whole lot of attention, and then they are unceremoniously dumped in the teacher's desk once Otis plays with them too many times.
I remember them being at the checkout counters of grocery stores when I was a kid. You would get these little plastic boxes filled with Mexican jumping beans, and half of them were dead all the time.
I remember seeing them at like service stations, at gas stations, right. Like up with the chewing tobacco and the cigarettes. They were always available. But Austin arranged, she actually starts a whisper campaign with the other students to get them interested in the beat, so that when it comes time for them to, like, they do a weird, like, exercise, like, "Let's do the news of the day. who has something to report? And Austin immediately raises her hand. She's like, Ellen brought a beat. It's like, all right, that's right. That's right. Ellen brought a beat on the board. And then Austin has arranged it so the only thing that gets mentioned throughout the news of the day is Ellen's beat and Ellen talking about the beat. So that at the end, you assume that Ellen gets to talk about the beat because we never actually get to it. Because that's not the point of the story. Like, you're suddenly, it ends with Ellen getting to go clap the erasers. Like, it works. Ellen gets the teacher's attention, but the beat is, because at the end of the day, for all the work, it wasn't about the beat. It was about Ellen getting the attention of the teacher enough that the teacher allows Ellen to go out and clap erasers. Ellen thanks her for it, admits that she's always wanted to do it, and the teacher's like, oh, you should have just told me. I would have let you go out and clap erasers. I just thought you didn't want to get dirty. It's a weirdly structured story.
Right. Well, the other thing that happens is Otis was originally going to go clap erasers with Ellen, which would be sort of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. But then as punishment for the fact that he will not put his jumping beans away, Miss Joyce chooses Austin to go out with Ellen. And I just want to mention, because we've mentioned a lot about the illustrations of these books, the illustration of Lewis Darling's illustration of Ellen and Austin clapping erasers together is another one of those perfectly beautiful children's books illustrations. And anyone who cares about children's books illustrations should get a copy of this book with the Lewis Darling pictures, and particularly search out that one illustration, because it is just beautiful.
Now, I want to talk to you about the illustration in my edition of the book, which is the new illustrations, and looks like the illustrator doesn't know how people's bodies work or what erasers do. I'm going to hold this up. You can't. Steve, can you see?
Hold on. Let me pull out Skype. Oh God. Oh yeah. Yeah. No. That's not good.
It's replaced with a totally undynamic picture of two
right,
children.
Right. Do you see this?
See, that's amazing. That's an amazing drawing. And also, since the new editions of the book modernize all the illustrations, it also doesn't make any sense, because kids don't clap erasers anymore. Like, that's not part of your daily schooling. That's a callback to an older time. And to see a modern Ellen in like this little jacket and Austin in jeans and a sweatshirt and like modern sandals clapping erasers outside of brick school, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, it's a story very much set in its time.
Well, we should move on before we become too weepy old men.
Ellen lies to Austin. She doesn't lie. She in the next chapter is founded all on Ellen selectively telling the truth about having experience riding horses. She tells Austin that she's ridden. Austin is obsessed with horse books, kind of like, I guess, like the Saddle Club girls would be obsessed with today, like 20 years ago.
Haven't you ever ridden a horse? Asked Ellen. No, have you? Austin sounded impressed. Oh, yes, said Ellen casually, several times. It was true. She had ridden several times. If she had ridden twice, she would have said a couple of times. Three was several times. So she had told the truth. Here, what was it like? Tell me about it, begged Austin. Oh, different places. That was also true. She had ridden at the beach. Her father had rented a horse for an hour and had let Ellen ride behind him with her arms around his waist. The horse's back had been slippery and she had bounced harder than was comfortable, but she had managed to hang on. And she had ridden at Uncle Fred's farm. Uncle Fred had lifted her up onto the back of his old plow horse, Lady, and led her twice around the barnyard. Lady didn't bounce her at all. And then there was that other time when her father had paid a dime so she could ride a pony around in a circle inside a fence. It hadn't been very exciting. The pony seemed tired, but Ellen had pretended it was galloping madly. Yes, all added up to several times.
And Austin is like, oh my God, like the word goes around school that Ellen knows how to ride horses. And Ellen won't correct the assumption because she doesn't want to be caught lying. to her best friend. Well, she goes on a picnic with Austin and her family and or her parents, because I keep forgetting that Austin has an older brother who like gets mentioned once or twice. They on the side of the road is hay horseback rides. Austin begs her mom and dad, can we go riding horses? Trust me, Ellen knows all about riding horses. And they get into a pickle.
And, you know, this we talk about the last time about how Ribsy is a great dog because he's allowed to be a dog. In this chapter, the horses are allowed to be horses because, you know, I have a cousin-in-law who does dressage and she knows her horses. But my experience as a child riding horses is much closer to Ellen's. I had maybe two or three instances where I was put up on a horse and I had absolutely no idea what to do. And if you have no idea what to do, a horse will not care at all and will do whatever the horse wants to do. And I just adore the fact that the horses just are allowed again to be horses in this chapter.
Ellen's and, horse, because Austin has learned how to ride a horse simply by reading books. Like, she knows how to work at horse. She understands the lingo. She knows how to hold the reins. Again, Austin is a really smart kid.
Right.
But no, these are horses. Like, they aren't wild. They aren't super friendly. They are work horses. They are doing their thing. And they realize that Ellen isn't going to be able to control them. And so Ellen's horse just wanders into a stream, a river, and just stops moving, which is great.
It's great. I mean, it's the sort of thing that, again, looking back on it from our perspective, it can seem very funny and quaint. But of course, from a child's perspective, it's absolutely terrifying.
From an adult perspective, it is. the one thing I think this chapter does great is it captures that feeling where you've been caught exaggerating about your own abilities, and now you're stuck in a situation where, I mean, this has happened to me in life. Like, you don't want to admit your own incompetence because you'll be embarrassed. And rather than just saying, I don't know what to do, you keep trying to fake it. And all that's doing is digging you deeper and deeper into this hole. And I think that Beverly Cleary perfectly captures what that's like, because it's not dramatic. It's very still and it's very internal and no one else realizes what's going on with you. And that's what's happening with Ellen. She's not doing anything. She freezes on this horse and Austin's like, come on, make your horse go. And it's all happening in Ellen's head. She's just like, I don't know what to do. And she's kind of having this mini breakdown. And the horse, like in a movie, in a children's cartoon, the horse would go nuts, would be galloping around or trying to throw her. And this is such a, it just, everything stops. And it's all, there's people up above, like hikers are laughing at her because she's stuck. And it's just this humiliation that I think Beverly Cleary is very good at writing, a child's humiliation.
But of course, Austin, again, is the perfect friend, because after Ellen receives the help of a couple of hikers who lead the horse out of the river, Austin acknowledges that she knows that Ellen has been exaggerating her abilities, but she tries to find a generous way out. She tries to say, oh, your horse was hard to manage. And Ellen is extremely grateful.
Extremely grateful. And I didn't notice this until I read the book a few times, that this is a 7-chapter book. The first 3 chapters are the ballet story and then the 2-part beat story. Then there's this chapter in the middle, and then we have 3 chapters that are their own story with it, which is the falling, the destruction of their friendship and the slow rebuilding of it. And I really see this as a pivotal chapter because Austin has saved Ellen's bacon a couple of times now through her own goodness, through just being a good friend. a friendship that started with Ellen yelling at Austin, like snapping at her, saying like, stop talking about California. We're all sick of it. And Austin has been a good, solid friend. To me, this chapter, Austin gives Ellen more of a side eye at the end of this chapter than she has in the book so far. She does let Ellen get away with it, but I get more of a sense that she's getting wise. She's getting a little tired of Ellen's stuff. Like, there's a few straws here, and we're about to have the straw that breaks the camel's back in the next storyline. Because I don't think that this chapter ends with Austin being totally cool with Ellen anymore.
No, I'll agree with that. I think that the other thing that you recognize as you read this through a few times that I didn't realize is that this goes, this is a story that starts, it starts with the school, the end of the school year. This is happening in the summer, and now it's going into August, and so it kind of has this framing seasonal device that I think becomes a lot more important in some of the later books. I think that Cleary is much more interested in the passage of time as we go along. And I don't know that it's so pivotal in this book, but I just do recognize it as another layer of the artistry here.
I would argue that it is pivotal because all the next action, all the rest of the book occurs under a new teacher.
Right.
And Ellen's used to her teacher, who is so kind and so thoughtful and so young and pretty. There's a new teacher who seems a little less connected to the kids, a little more standoffish, but on multiple readings, seems to have a firmer grasp of what is happening to the children than she lets on. And so let's dive into this. This is three chapters that all kind of tell one story. Let's try to cover them all in one chunk here.
Sure.
Over the summer, Ellen and Ellen's come up with the idea that they're going to dress alike on the first day of school. They're going to have their mothers make matching dresses. And Ellen's comes out perfectly. The first day of school, Austin's mother finally finishes hers, and it comes out not looking great. It doesn't fit. It's incomplete, and most importantly, it's missing its sash on the back, which Ellen has tied into a bow. And Austin is embarrassed, and this is the first time we've ever really seen Austin quiet and sort of angry. And you can tell she's mad because she's embarrassed at how her dress doesn't look as good as Ellen's. Ellen is trying to be cool about it, but Austin keeps untying Ellen's sash and being kind of mean-spirited about it. She does it on the way to school. She does it. Ellen can't take the sash off because it's sewn to her dress, and she's kind of secretly happy about that. She does it in the classroom. The kids think it's kind of weird that they tried to dress alike anyway. They thought it was going to be cool, but the kids are like, why'd you dress alike? Otis is making fun of the dresses because they have monkeys on them. And then they get into line, and someone unties Ellen's dress. And Ellen assumes it's Austin because Austin is standing right behind her and has done it twice. She's so furious, she spins around and slaps her in the face, which is shocking. It's a huge deal in this storyline and in this book. And you're never really, as a reader, you may suspect that Austin wasn't the one who did it, but you're not really given any reason to not suspect that because she's done it twice already.
Again, I have to say this related in my mind to an incident I had as a child where I was in a gym class with some kids, and I jokingly slapped another kid on the back. And when he took his shirt off, there was a large red handprint on the back. And well, again, it was one of those moments of absolute horror at what I had done, because I had not intentionally thought that I had hit him as hard as that. But I had hit him as hard as that. And then the shame of feeling like I might get found out, the concern that this kid was going to get retribution against me somehow. I mean, ultimately, the kid kind of laughed it off and he didn't care. But that stuck with me. It sticks with me to this day. I sometimes think about it and my face flushes and I think, oh my God, I was a real jerk back in third grade or something like that. And, you know, and I've been told by my therapist, you know, John, you know, it's time to let it go. But I
have this young man here today. He's going to slap you on the back. We can put this all behind us.
But I do think that this again captures that sense of shock when you're a kid, that people may not have the experience of actually physically striking another child, but I think everybody has done something really stupid as a child and had that sudden right realization of just how badly they've screwed up.
Yeah. And then Beverly Cleary does something really fascinating with it, in my opinion, which is she immediately takes Ellen's like inner monologue, and Ellen feels shame. She feels, you know, wigged out. She feels upset at what she's done. And then you see her transform it into, well, this was Austin's fault anyway. So Austin needs to apologize to me because she's at fault. I bet Austin wants to apologize. She just doesn't know how to. So every time I see her, I'm going to smile nicely so she feels comfortable coming up to me and apologizing. All right. And so you see Ellen just trying to catch Austin's eye for the rest of the day so that Austin feels comfortable apologizing for making Ellen slap her. But, of course, that doesn't work. And what ends up happening is Ellen's not going to own up to the responsibility for this. And, of course, Austin doesn't move on, but she ends up blowing Ellen off and embracing one of the other girls as her best friend at that point. Mostly for Ellen's benefit. You get the sense that Austin is doing this for show, because she makes sure that Ellen overhears certain things being said about her whenever Ellen's within earshot.
Yeah. This was interesting to me because I come from a family of very unexpressive people and the idea of this kind of open demonstration, the kind of politicking that goes on especially between this age of girls, between who's going to be whose friend or not. This is completely foreign to the way I was as a kid. I was much more of a Henry Huggins myself, much more of a loner. I just kind of assumed people didn't like me. And I just kind of stayed on the sidelines. But I reading it now as an adult, you know, and having had kids myself, I see that constant jockeying for who's in and who's out in the group, and part of all those things that make childhood such a garden of adult neuroses.
Yeah, and I think Beverly Cleary does it well. She doesn't overplay her hand too much with the politics of it all. I think that a lot of that has to do with how smart she makes Austin in the beginning, and how, as readers, we're left to sympathize a lot with Austin. She lets you feel Austin's pain at the dress situation, and I think she doesn't try to make excuses for Ellen. Like, Ellen is definitely at fault, and it's hard to be entirely on her side because you know as a reader that Ellen should be the one apologizing.
Right. Well, this is, I think, for a lot of children, if not the first, one of the first examples of a unreliable narrator, insofar as we are given Ellen's interior monologue, but no one is going to agree with it. And the narrative voice at this point, I think any child reading this or any child hearing it read to them will want to fight back against that and want to say, Ellen, why aren't you taking responsibility for what you did. And that's a very nice move from the authorial point of view to have us suddenly questioning our I mean, as you've said throughout the book, Ellen has been difficult and hard to root for, but now she's obviously wrong, and we get a whole chapter in here of her self-delusion, and that's, I think, very it's a very interesting thing when you're a child to read, to grapple with that, because most children's narratives are not written where you're supposed to be in argument with the protagonist. You're supposed to.
It is an unusual thing, especially for a novel aimed at children this age, it requires a lot on the part of the reader to meet you, to meet the writer, to meet the author at that point. I think it assumes the child is at an intelligence level that most children, I think, are. I think most children get that there's something fishy going on with the way Ellen's thinking. And I think it's to the credit of Beverly Cleary that she expects children to be that smart.
So this three chapter arc comes to a kind of a, this is the one segment that is just a little bit wacky and does rely a little bit upon an almost sort of Shakespearean masquerade going on, which is there is a play, another one of these plays. I think about Henry Huggins and also in the Ramona books there are pageants involved and stuff. I don't think that there were that many of these plays when I was a kid, but they happen a lot in Clary, and they often involve elaborate costumes. And in this case, the elaborate costume is necessary because Ellen is going to be a substitute rat in a production of The Pied Piper of Hamelin. She doesn't get to be a primarily cast rat. She's there in case she's an understudy rat.
Oh, and this brings up an amazing has to be a comment by the author, which is, this isn't the Pied Piper of Hamelin straightforward. They've changed the ending so the Pied Piper brings the children back just so they can work in a maypole dance with all the children of the town. And Ellen doesn't sit well with her. She doesn't think you should be allowed to change the ending of a story just to work in a dance at the end. It seems wrong. It seems wrong to alter a story like that. And the teacher has to say, well, this is a creative play. And just sort of blow it off at that. But I loved that Beverly Cleary worked in this like indignant attitude about altering the author's intent in order to get a little more razzle dazzle out of your story.
Right. Well, I also think that the other thing about altering the end of the Pied Piper of Hamelin is the Pied Piper of Hamelin ends with the kids being lost. And it's a kind of a, and I think the concern here is, you know, even as early as 1951, there's a concern that about children, the stories for children being watered down, made a little tamer so that they don't cause distress. And so this may be kind of a hint at that.
Yeah. Like the teachers decided to alter the ending of the Pied Piper so that it wasn't so dark.
Right.
The kids are all indignant because they want the real story. Like, they're not bothered by the ending. The teachers were.
Yeah.
So it's also the opposite of Henry Huggins, because Ellen wanted to be in the play but didn't get cast, as is often the case in these situations. You're either forced into a show you don't want to be in, or you are not allowed into the show that you desperately want to be in. She wanted to be in it so that she could act with Austin, but there's no dialogue in the show anyway. It's all narration. Of course, because it's a story, the understudy rat, the substitute rat, is needed. On production day, and through a series of comical misadventures, Ellen ends up on stage when she's not supposed to be during the maypole dance. Austin comes to her aid, helps her get through the dance without embarrassing herself or disrupting the whole thing. But no one knows who the rat was, and Ellen overhears Austin saying to one of her friends, you know, like, the friend said, do you suppose that rat was Ellen Tebbets? And Austin says, of course it wasn't Ellen Tebbets. If I thought it was Ellen Tebbets, I wouldn't have helped her. And so Ellen thought that Austin was helping her because she knew it was her. Austin, you're led to believe, didn't know it was Ellen. At the end of the book, you find out that Austin did know it was Ellen. So she must have been saying that out loud for Ellen's benefit because she was still mad at her. Again, Austin knows how to start a whisper campaign, knows how to make sure the right things are overheard and said in order to influence the outcome of situations. Smart girl, smart girl.
But the other thing that Austin says out loud when she says that she wouldn't help the rat if she had known the rat was Ellen is that she never pulled Ellen's sash in the first place, that it was Otis, right? Who, and now you mentioned before, one of the problems with this book is Otis is kind of just there to be a brick wall for them to bang their heads against.
Otis is a tough character. He is patently unlikable. Like, and I understand that he's supposed to be that kid, but because the book is so psychologically complex for a children's book, it's Beverly Cleary. I can't help but read into Otis's character that there's more going on. Like, kids don't behave that way because they're bad human beings. Like, he's acting out. He's constantly looking for attention. He's constantly demanding people acknowledge him. People, I can't think of the word I'm looking for. He's looking for, I don't know what we're looking for, but he wants validation. He wants to be present in everyone's life, and he's such a cipher. Like, he's always there saying horrible things or doing horrible things and taking up time in the book that even though it doesn't end up doing it with this book, I feel that Otis Spofford is the reason the Ellen Tebbets verse, the stories of Ellen and her friends only go on for another book, because that book, which we will end up covering, is the book about Otis Spofford.
Right. Well, you know, as you mentioned this right now, it occurs to me, because you talk about Otis's need for validation, that Otis in some ways is the shadow Ellen himself, because in the same way that Ellen is craving her place in the world, Otis is too. It's just that Otis is obnoxiously and loudly broadcasting that, whereas Ellen is timidly waiting for people to come and give her the attention and love she needs. And so there is a kind of an interest. It may be a stretch, but I'll take this reading because it makes Otis a little bit more interesting to me, is that Otis is sort of what Ellen would have been if Ellen had the permission to let her id run free. And again, in a more gendered way, as a boy at this time, you know, there is the fact that Otis is the son of the dance teacher. He's he comes into this class that is highly feminized, and he's wearing his cowboy outfit, which is the accoutrement of the American male in the 1950s when the Western was just everything. And so in many ways, Otis is sort of like a 1950s cosplayer. He's going around wearing this, but you know,
it'll be interesting approaching the Otis Spofford book with that in mind, because the cover for Ellen Tebbets is traditionally the picture of Ellen in her ballet getup and Otis in his cowboy getup, and they're both doing a ballet pose, which, you know, like from a story perspective, it should be a picture of Ellen and Austin, because it looks like they're setting them up to be a book about this rivalry. I would have loved more of that in the book if Otis was a, I don't want to say a dark reflection of Ellen's interior, but what you were saying, like sort of like what Ellen could be, If there were any sort of positive spin put on Otis's behavior at all in this book, or if he were allowed to be more of a character instead of an obstacle, because, and I don't want to give, I haven't read Otis Spofford since I read it about a little less than a year ago, but I'm going to be interested going into Otis Spofford with that attitude, because the book didn't work for me. A little sneak preview. When I read it, I feel like Otis Spofford as a novel is a failure of a novel. In many different ways. And one of the reasons is because in this book, I don't feel like he's a real live boy. I feel like he's a literary device or he's a contrivance. And I kind of want to be done with him. Beverly Cleary is better at writing annoying characters. In a way, the Ellen Tebbets Otis Spofford relationship gets played out better in the Beezus and Ramona relationship later on. The young woman just trying to find her place in the world, and then this annoying presence constantly pulling her away from that, throwing reality in her face. I think she does that a lot better with Beezus and Ramona's relationship, which is a lot more grounded and a lot more realistic. We'll get to that, of course, very soon. But I don't know. I just find Otis such an irritating presence. It's very hard for me. I will attempt to read Otis Spofford from that angle, from your angle.
Cipher or non-character, it does turn out that Otis was the instigator.
He never admits it, though. He doesn't actually admit it. She asks him, and he just makes a face and runs off. And she's like, I knew it. And I'm like, oh, God. That leaves me like, was that true? Or did Austin pull the sash? Like, we never – she says she didn't. But I'm left wondering if she did pull the sash and that Otis is just – because he doesn't say yes. Like, so I'm left wondering if there is, if Austin was being a jerk at the end and got out of it. I don't know. That's my mind playing that game.
Well, it does make another interesting reading. So basically, again, the Mrs. Gittler, the new teacher, as you mentioned, has, I think, a much better understanding of what's going on.
Yeah.
And she pulls one of these couples counseling moves of having Ellen and Austin go out and clap razors again.
Yep.
I don't know whether she had any prior knowledge that she got about this being a favorite pastime of theirs, but in the same way we expect in a sitcom for a judge to condemn the bickering couple to a night together in a hotel, she's condemned them to go out and clap razors together.
And I think it's a very touching scene. I think it's written very well. It's emotional. The characters are allowed to cry. They're allowed to be embarrassed and sorry and admit their wrongdoings.
Right. And Ellen unties Austin's sash
again,
hoping that Austin will hit her.
Yes,
because she wants there to be some sort of recompense here.
Yeah, and that moment is played, I think, very well, because it doesn't explain what Ellen's doing when she does it.
The longer Ellen looked at Austin's back, the madder she became. All right, if she wants to stay mad, she can, for all I care, thought Ellen. So there. Then, Ellen noticed the end of Austin's narrow sash hanging below her sweater. She was so angry she acted without thinking. Dropping her erasers, she grabbed Austin's sash and yanked with all her strength. There was a ripping, tearing sound. The bow not only came untied, but, to Ellen's horror, one end of the sash tore loose from the dress and hung limply in her hand. Austin whirled and faced Ellen. Her cheeks were red and her eyes blazed. Ellen was frightened. She wanted to run, but somehow she could not move. She looked at Austin and then stared in dismay at the jagged hole in her dress and the limp sash in her hand. What had she done now? What would Austin do to her? Ellen knew she had to say something. They just couldn't stand there staring at each other all day. She gulped and blinked her eyes to keep back the tears. I guess I tore your dress, she said, looking at the ground. She waited for Austin to move or to speak, but Austin was silent. Ellen took a deep breath. I sort of expected you to, well, slap me, she said timidly, drawing an imaginary line on the ground with her toe. She almost hoped Austin would slap her. At least, she would feel better if they were even.
I find it to be I think it's a very moving moment in a children's book. It's a very like unsettling adult, strange scene, and they end up making up. They end up becoming friends again.
Right. They have another bonding moment over underwear, calling that back again. They talk about the rats, and then we end with them clapping erasers and calling Otis Spofford by the very strange. The very strange epithet of Pie Face, which comes up again later on in the Ramona books.
Yes, it's funny because they sort of bond over everything, and then they bond over humiliating this boy who just came out to be like, "What are you?" The teacher said to come back in. What's taking you so long? And if Otis was having issues at this point, they did not help.
So. As I said at the beginning, reading this book again, I am struck at how artfully constructed as a novel it is. I do not have as many memories of this book. It may simply be because, again, I will freely admit that as a child, I had much stronger gender expectations, and I felt closer to Henry than I did to Ellen, but I will always remember the beat segment, and that came back. All those memories came flooding back to me when I read that again. And again, the image of happily clapping erasers, I don't know why in my head it's sort of like a Tom Sawyer painting or whitewashing the fence moment for me. It's just kind of like this perfect little moment, partly I guess because I think that illustration so perfectly encapsulated it. Sometimes that happens when you're a child. You just see an illustration, you read it, and it just sticks in your head.
Yeah, I had read it when I was a kid. It didn't particularly stick with me, but I was always a Ramona reader, and this one didn't spin off into much of a series, so I didn't have like a whole lot of books to hang on to. But in rereading it, it holds up. It's again a far more complex book than Henry Huggins. It's showing Beverly Cleary delving into the sort of grimmer side of a child psychology of the way kids interact. It starts playing on that whole, like, I love stories about kids being terrible to each other and then being friends again, because that's what kids are. Childhood is fickle. Your friendships are transient, and they change. Your attitudes change. And I like children's books that acknowledge that sometimes friends are awful to each other, because that's just the way life is. I think it's a solid... A solid second novel. I think it's like I said, leaps above the pacing and structure of Henry Huggins.
You have been listening to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast, featuring John McCoy and Phil Gonzalez. Today's readings were by Ilana Gravitz. Join Click It Cast next time for Henry and Beezus. Click It Cast is part of the Incomparable Network. To find more shows on the Incomparable Network, visit www.theincomparable.com. The Incomparable Network. Smart. Funny. Podcasts.